Well, let's see how long I can go today before someone stops me. We got up to slide 10. Let me make sure that I beat slide 9 to death first. Oh, yeah. We got all that. What we're looking at here is the idea of axes. An endocrine axis is an arrangement of a functional arrangement of structures indicated by these arrows. It has to do with the fact that, as we've been talking about already, a certain hormone will be released, which has the effect of releasing a second hormone elsewhere and maybe even a third elsewhere. So the structures that are involved collectively form an axis. For instance, you can talk about the hypothalamo-pituitary-gonadal axis, because all three of those in succession are involved. We've really talked about almost all of this, but just as review here, TRH is coming from the hypothalamus here as part of an axis. What is TRH? Thyrotropin-releasing hormone, which, remember, is not a thyrotropin, right? Thyrotropin-releasing hormone releases the actual thyrotropin from where it's produced, which is the pituitary. What part of the pituitary? The anterior pituitary, otherwise known as the adenohypophysis. So that's the second organ in the axis, the anterior pituitary. And then, following the arrow, that second organ in the axis, the anterior pituitary, can release thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is an actual thyrotropin. Right? And then you have the thyroid responding to that by releasing still another hormone, the thyroid hormones. Okay? Otherwise known as... Well, there's actually two thyroid hormones, which we'll talk about in a minute. But that's just an example of an axis. And so the same thing is happening elsewhere. The hypothalamus and the pituitary have central importance in the endocrine system. The hypothalamus controls the pituitary, and the pituitary is kind of the master gland because its job is to secrete hormones for broadcast throughout the body that control not only tissues as an end result, but also control other organs situated in the rest of the body. Okay. Just quickly, though, let's talk about what these things stand for. What's GnRH? Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, right? CRH? Corticotropin-releasing hormone, GHRH, growth hormone-releasing hormone, right? GH itself is growth hormone, but GHRH is a different chemical. What's PRL? Prolactin, promotes lactation. LH and FSH, what about LH? Luteinizing hormone and FSH? Follicle-stimulating hormone. Together, they both are classified as what? They are gonadotropins because they directly affect the gonads, ovaries and testes. ACTH? Right, adrenocorticotropic hormone. Now, so what causes adrenocorticotropic hormone to be released? Corticotropin-releasing hormone, because adrenocorticotropic hormone, as the name indicates, is an actual corticotropin, right? Why is it named a corticotropin? No, it's not. Tropin means affecting, having an effect on, or working on. So why is adrenocorticotropin-releasing hormone a corticotropin. Right, it acts on the adrenal cortex. It's not released from it. Where is adrenocorticotropic hormone released from? The anterior pituitary, in response to corticotropin-releasing hormone, because ACTH is the corticotropin. But the cortico part of the name refers to the cortex of the adrenal gland. All right, and that's not the end of the line in terms of hormones, because in response to adrenocorticotropic hormone, the adrenal cortex will secrete its own hormones. Third one's in line, which is typical for an axis. Okay. Let's go to 11. Yesterday, toward the end, I think I was talking about oxytocin and during parturition. Didn't I go through that? The positive feedback mechanism? Okay, so that's an example of a positive feedback mechanism. It's not the only one, but positive feedback mechanisms are fairly relatively uncommon. The vast majority of feedback mechanisms are negative feedback mechanisms. Those are the ones that maintain homeostasis, because negating the error, whatever that error is, that difference between what you really have and what you would like, the set point and the real value, negating that error is why it's called negative feedback. So if it's too high a level, negative feedback will bring it back down. If it's too low a level, negative feedback will bring it back up. Positive feedback will make it the error even worse than it was, or bigger than it was. So that's how most feedback mechanisms in general work, including feedback mechanisms that help to regulate the secretion of hormones in the endocrine system. So this is kind of a representative of what generally happens. It's not really, I don't want you to think that this is, it's only involves the thyroid. We're just using the thyroid gland here as an example of what's called negative feedback inhibition, or sometimes just feedback inhibition for shorthand. It's called feedback inhibition because something in the process feeds back to an earlier stage and inhibits the production of more of that stuff. All right? And this doesn't work just for hormones. This works, for instance, in biochemical reactions that produce some sort of product. A biochemical pathway is a set of reactions, right? Each individual reaction is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So unless that enzyme is working, the reaction doesn't happen very much. Basically, you're turning that reaction off if the enzyme is inhibited. So if you need to get from A to D, but you turn A into B and B into C and then C into D, you're involving three enzymes to do that. If you need D for whatever reason, then of course you want that pathway to operate. After you have enough D and you're no longer using it up for whatever you need it for, it's going to start to accumulate if you keep making it. And that's an error. So by negative feedback inhibition, that D itself will start to interfere with the enzyme that turns A into B. It'll turn that enzyme off. And if you turn off production of B, you can't make C, and therefore you can't make D. So by feeding back to the earlier part of the process, you are inhibiting additional production of something you already have enough of. Same thing's happening here in this specific example, thyroid hormones. T3 and T4 are their nicknames for the thyroid hormones. The thyroid hormones themselves, in addition to affecting most organs in the body are affected by thyroid hormone. Unlike most other hormones we're talking about, they don't have real specific receptor organs. Most tissues respond to thyroid hormones. But in addition to doing the job that thyroid hormones do, which is to elevate metabolism, the hormones feed back to the hypothalamus and to the anterior pituitary. That's the branching of the two branches of the red arrow here. Red indicating inhibition, green arrows indicating stimulation. So as we've already discussed, thyrotropin-releasing hormone from the hypothalamus has a stimulatory effect on its target tissue. But its target tissue is the cells of the anterior pituitary that are responsible for making the actual thyrotropin, right? Which is thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH. What specific cells in the anterior pituitary do that? Produce that TSH? Thyrotropes. Right? Thyrotropes produce the actual thyrotropin, which is thyroid-stimulating hormone. So, thyroid-stimulating hormone, of course, also has a stimulatory effect, but its stimulatory effect is on its own target tissue, which is the thyroid gland itself. And so, when TSH is present in the bloodstream, it will tell the thyroid gland to produce its own secretory product, which is T3 and T4, or the thyroid hormones. Well, if you already have enough of that, you don't want to keep making more. And that's why a buildup of thyroid hormones will feed back earlier and say, shut down the process for now. We already have enough thyroid hormones in circulation. That's classic feedback inhibition. And so that's what happens in basically all of these axes, not just the one that involves the thyroid. The specific axis, though, would be the hypothalamo-pituitary-thyroid axis. Okay, to 12 now. We're looking at a youngster and an oldster here to compare the pretty drastic difference in size of the thymus in each of these stages of life. The thymus is an endocrine organ. Like a lot of organs are, it is endocrine. It's officially a member of the endocrine system because it produces some endocrine product. But it's also a member of some other organ system. Like the skin, for instance, is also an endocrine organ. But its major job is to be a member of the integumentary system. Similarly, the pancreas is an endocrine organ, but it's also a digestive organ. Same thing for the liver, and so on. Well, the thymus will study, again, and that's true for a lot of these organs that are members of the endocrine system. We don't take a very close look at them here because we deal with them again in the organ system that they're also a member of when we study those. The thymus is a member of the lymphatic system as well, because it's important in immunity, which is a major function of the lymphatic system. We often talk about the immune system, by the way. The immune system isn't really officially an organ system. Immunity is a major function of the lymphatic system, but we have yet to study that. And anyway, we'll get back to the thymus. For this chapter, I just want you to realize that the thymus is an organ in which certain types of blood vessels develop and mature before they're ready to go for their main job. And specifically, I'm talking about a type of lymphocyte. Overall, the dichotomy of blood cell types is that there's red cells and there's white cells, right? Some white cells, within one human, there's only one kind of red blood cell. All your red blood cells are the same. But your white cells come in five major categories and then subcategories of those. Anyway, specifically, the cells that get sent to the thymus to differentiate into a certain kind of cell become what are called T lymphocytes. And that's what the T stands for, the fact that they mature in the thymus. Now, the thymus doesn't produce these cells. The cells in an immature state get sent to the thymus and then mature there. But, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the immune system. Where do they come from, by the way? You might already know this. From bone marrow. All blood cells come from stem cells that exist as part of the marrow, whether it's red or any of the kind of white. So these certain kinds of white cells end up in the thymus, and then because of the endocrine action of thymus gland cells, those immature, not yet officially T lymphocytes, mature into functional T lymphocytes, and then they're released to the rest of the body where they help in defending us against invading microorganisms. Okay? So we'll talk about the immune function later, but it's also an endocrine organ because it produces a few kinds of hormones that are related to each other and similar in structure and that help out in this maturation process. But back to this difference in sizes, notice that the thymus, well, first of all, before we compare that, the thymus anatomically is located in the space between the lungs. What do we call that area? It's the sternal region, if you think of it skeletally. That's where the sternum is. But I'm talking about a cavity. You have the thorax. The thoracic cavity is the major cavity, and both lungs are in there. But then if you imagine nothing between the lungs, there would be a space there. That's where the heart is and various kinds of plumbing, the trachea and esophagus, but also the thymus gland. That whole space, though, between the two lungs, no one knows what that's called? I think you had to know that. Oh, maybe you didn't. Maybe you didn't. Why did you have to know that for 201? It's not really not part of 201. Maybe that's why you don't know it. It's called the mediastinum. Don't have a pen. Mediastinum. The mediastinum is just a space. It's not a structure. So that's where the heart is. That's where the trachea is. But that's also where the thymus is. And you can see the striking difference in size for someone very young, a newborn, and someone very old. That's because the thymus undergoes what's called involution. Involution means a decrease in size with age. And this is not just because it's wearing out or anything like that. It's kind of a programmed involution. It's supposed to happen. In fact, it starts occurring at puberty because one of the things that causes involution is the production of sex hormones, which occurs at puberty. Well, it makes sense that this involution occurs because, well, you tell me, why is it more important for a newborn to have a big thymus than someone who's lived a life? Right. They don't have a very well-developed set of immune cells to protect them against the things that they're going to encounter, which is, you know, why they so easily get sick. The more we're exposed to, the more adaptive immunity we acquire through experience. We are exposed to things, and our immune system remembers that through certain memory cells. Well, the thymus is important more so early on for that reason, and less so. In a person about 80, you can barely see the thymus anymore. But it gradually declines starting at about puberty. All right, let's go to 13 and look at the thyroid gland in a little bit greater detail. Now, things that end in OID mean, that OID suffix means like, right? So thyroid means whatever, like whatever thyre means. The thyre part of that word means shield. So thyroid means shield-like. Well, the thyroid gland is not very shield-like. It's really shaped more or less like a butterfly. A butterfly that wraps around, or whose wings wraps around partially the trachea. If we looked at the back of the trachea, those two wing-like parts of the thyroid would almost touch each other, but not quite. So it doesn't completely encircle the trachea, but almost. Anyway, the thyroid gland does not look like a shield. It's not named for its appearance. The thyroid gland is named for the fact that it is close to a piece of cartilage of the larynx called the thyroid cartilage, which itself is shaped like a shield. So the thyroid cartilage is named for its shape. The thyroid gland is named for its proximity to the thyroid cartilage. Notice that there are some major vessels running to the thyroid gland in this picture. This is slide 13 in case I haven't mentioned it. That's because the thyroid gland is one of the most highly perfused organs in the body. Perfusion refers to the flow of blood through a tissue. And so the thyroid gland is very richly vascularized. A lot of the branches into a lot of vessels that permeate through its substance, and it receives a lot of blood flow. That's why it's so reddish in color, because it's full of blood, basically. It also makes it easy for thyroid hormones, which of course are produced by the thyroid gland, to get picked up by this blood and sent throughout the body, which makes sense because the thyroid hormones, like I was just saying earlier, have a more generalized effect. They affect a lot of the body's tissues, not just one or two here or there. If you look at the histological structure in the close-up view on B here, you can see that the overall thyroid gland is organized into little follicles, little empty chambers. Well, I shouldn't say empty chambers. They're not empty. They're filled with colloid, but they're not. The interior of the follicles isn't cellular. The walls of the follicles are made of cells, and that's why those are called follicular cells, the ones that stain darkly here. The pink interior is not empty. The pink interior really is filled with a colloid, which is a type of suspension, so something that's not actually dissolved, but held in a liquid, kind of like shaken up salad dressing, a colloid of thyroglobulin. Now, thyroglobulin we'll look at in greater detail later on in this chapter, but this is a protein mixture that includes the thyroid hormones in it. Now, there are two thyroid hormones which are nicknamed T3 and T4. T3 stands for triiodothyronine, and T4 stands for tetraiodothyronine. The difference, as the prefaces imply, is the number of iodines that are in those hormones. T3 has 3 iodines, T4 has 4. T4 is by far more potent, and it's also what most of the secretory product that ends up finally in the bloodstream is, T4. That's what really has most of its effect on the tissues. But when we say thyroid hormones, or even just thyroid hormone, we're talking about a mixture of both of those, T3 and T4. Well, they're not, they're stored in the thyroid by being bound to this globulin protein, which is why we call the whole mixture thyroglobulin. And this makes sense because, as we'll discuss more later in the chapter, some hormones are hydrophobic and some are hydrophilic. Now, the majority of hormones are made out of either protein or amino acids. They're protein-based, basically. And those are hydrophobic, they're hydrophilic, which means that they cannot penetrate a membrane. Right? Hydrophilic things don't mind being in the extracellular fluid or the intracellular fluid, but they don't want to be around those tails that make up the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer of a plasma membrane. So most hormones these ones that are amino acid based, they don't enter the cell in order to have their effect. They have to just knock on the door by binding to a receptor that's facing the exterior of the cell. The steroid hormones, on the other hand, which includes not only the sex hormones but all the ones that are based, that are made from cholesterol, all the ones that are steroids. Cholesterol is a lipid, and so all these lipid hormones, like lipids in general, are hydrophobic. And so they have no problem slipping right through the membrane. Well, thyroid hormones, T3 and T4, are an exception to the rule that amino acid-based hormones are hydrophilic. Thyroid hormone is hydrophobic. It's the only one that's not a steroid hormone that will go right through plasma membranes. And that's why to store it, you have to bind it to something else that's not going to get through the membrane. When it finally gets released into the bloodstream, it still has to be stored. I mean, to keep it in the bloodstream, it has to actually be bound to another protein that's part of the plasma. And then it gradually comes off of that protein and can enter the cells of the body where it has its effect. So we have, at any given time, enough thyroid hormone stored in our thyroid gland. Oh, I forget the statistic. To last about 2 weeks, maybe, something like that. If you were to totally shut off production of new thyroid hormone, there's still enough to not even know a difference stored in your thyroid at any given time. But, of course, you're using it all the time, too, so you keep replenishing the store of it. There's more than just follicular cells, though, histologically speaking. Notice that between the follicles are these fairly bright-looking or clear-looking regions that include parafollicular cells, meaning next to the follicle. Parafollicular cells are also called C cells, which actually, I think, stands for clear because of how they look. They don't take the stain up as nicely as the follicular cells do. So parafollicular cells are also endocrine cells. They're also part of the stuff that makes up the thyroid gland, but they have their own secretory product. And that hormone that the parafollicular cells makes is called calcitonin. Now, calcitonin is important in early life, but something we can live without as we beyond puberty. So very little of it actually ends up being made after puberty. Anyway, as far as function is concerned, calcitonin, well, what does the name tell you it must involve?
Calcium.
Calcium, right. It's part of calcium homeostasis. There are two hormones involved, but one of which is much more important. It's not this one. Calcitonin is the minor one, but they have opposite effects. The other one that is also involved in adjusting the blood levels of calcium, or calcemia, is parathyroid hormone. Not thyroid hormone, parathyroid hormone. All right. Calcitonin decreases calcemia, or it decreases the level of calcium in the blood. The emia part of any word that has that means in the blood, like uremia means urea content in the blood, or glycemia is blood sugar content, and so on. So if calcitonin is released, that's going to be a signal to decrease the amount of calcium that's in the blood at the moment. And actually, we already talked about this a little bit in Bio 201, I think. We should have. I seem to recall talking about it. Anyone remember this? Well, if you're going to decrease the amount of calcium in the blood, you don't just destroy the calcium. It has to go somewhere, right? What do you do with extra calcium? You store it, but how do you store it? And where? In the emergency room? What is our major store of calcium when we're not using it in the blood and in the other tissues? No? Bone. Yeah. Calcium is part of hydroxyapatite. Hydroxyapatite is the mineral stuff that makes our bones so hard. In the architectural analogy, that was the concrete part, right? When I likened it to an architectural column, hydroxyapatite, including calcium, makes it very resistant to compressive forces. Well, that's good for the bones for their strength, but that's not the only function of bones, is to be strong, right? A major function of bones is to be a storehouse for calcium. So when you want to take calcium out of the blood, because the level is too high, calcitonin will cause extra calcium to be put into the bones. Now, what kind of cells in the bones would be activated by calcitonin? Which is an indirect way of saying, what type of bone cells are responsible for producing more hydroxyapatite? What did you say? You're combining two different words. Blast and cyte. What is the prefix we should be using if we're talking about bone? Osteoblasts, yes. Osteoblasts, remember, are the ones, like any blast, that produce the extracellular matrix. In the case of osteoblasts, they're producing hydroxyapatite. So oxytocin tells osteoblasts, ramp up, or get on the job, take the calcium out of the blood and make more hard, bony material, which is exactly the opposite of what happens in response to parathyroid hormone. But parathyroid hormone has nothing to do with the thyroid gland. It's not produced by the thyroid gland. It's produced by the parathyroid glands, which we look at now in 14. Para, once again, means beside, like parapsychology. For most people, there are four parathyroid glands. We're looking at them right here. This also gives you a back view of the thyroid gland, like I was talking about before. The wings of the butterfly shape don't wrap all the way around, but almost. So this is a posterior view we're looking at here, but we're done talking about the thyroid gland. The interest here are these four yellowish and elliptical or ovoid parathyroid glands. And in most people, there are four of them, but there's variability. Just like for all anatomy, there's variability from individual to individual. Some will have fewer, some will have more. Most people have four. And those four, for most people, are situated as though they're embedded on the surface, the posterior surface of the thyroid gland, which is why they get their name. But there's variability with that anatomically as well. Some in other people, they might not all be on the thyroid gland. They're somewhere in this pharyngeal region, the region of the pharynx. However many there are. Okay, so this is the normal situation. And if we look histologically at parathyroid glands, what we're looking at in the detail here. Notice that each parathyroid gland is what makes it yellowish in appearance when you dissect, is that each gland is covered by a layer of adipose tissue, which are just cells containing fat, right? It's packaging material, like fat is used elsewhere in the body. And then deep to the adipose tissue is where the actual parathyroid gland proper starts, and its outer surface is the parathyroid capsule. So it has kind of a fibrous capsule, just a protective lining. And then deep to that, which is most of the volume, because these outer layers aren't very thick, most of the volume is filled by the endocrine cells themselves that make up the bulk of the actual parathyroid gland. And so those are endocrine cells, all these little pink ones in the interior. These are the ones that produce parathyroid hormone. Now, as I said earlier, calcitonin, no big deal if you don't make that anymore after a certain age. You can easily live without calcitonin. parathyroid hormone you definitely need. And one problem is that thyroid glands run into problems often, so people sometimes have to have thyroidectomies, removal of the thyroid, which isn't a big deal even though thyroid hormone is important, simply because it's easy to just take it in pill form or whatever for the rest of your life, thyroid hormone. The problem with taking off the thyroid gland, though, is that usually means removal of parathyroid glands as well, which means you have to make up for that loss of parathyroid hormone because you can't live without that. Well, so since parathyroid hormone acts antagonistically to calcitonin, what type of cells must be the target of parathyroid hormone? Osteoclasts, yes. Osteoclasts, remember, are cells whose job it is to degrade or break down the extracellular matrix, which is that hydroxyapatite, chock full of calcium. The reason they're doing that is not to make the bone thinner. The main idea here, the reason parathyroid hormone exists, is as a signal to increase the calcium ion level in the blood. Well, where you get that calcium, if you need it, is from storage, which is the bone itself. Now, you're getting calcium from the diet as well, but you have a big store of it in your skeleton, and parathyroid hormone ensures that the blood level of calcium never gets dangerously low. As it gets low, though, it's going to create a negative feedback mechanism whereby parathyroid hormone is released by the parathyroid glands in order to negate that signal and bring the level back up. Okay, now we can go on to 15 and look at the adrenal gland in more detail. There are two adrenal glands because there's one per kidney. Remember, the name means on the kidney, and you see in this picture where it's situated. It forms kind of a cap on the top or superior aspect of each kidney. And also in cross-section, you can appreciate the fact that an adrenal gland is an example of something that has a cortex and a medulla deep to that. Cortex always refers to the more superficial layer. So that's why we separately talk about the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla, not only because they look different, but because they have different origins of development and different functions as well. In 201, we discussed the adrenal medulla. What can you tell me about that? What is, histologically, what is the adrenal medulla made up of? Or what did I say was special about it in terms of anything that you remember? Anything? You purged all the 201 information from your brain? Well, remember when we were talking about preganglionic and postganglionic neurons? Right? There's a neuron until you get to a ganglion where that first neuron, the preganglionic neuron, innervates or synapses with the postganglionic neuron at the cell body, which is what makes that a ganglion. That's the wiring of the sympathetic nervous system, right? You have a preganglionic neuron, then a postganglionic neuron. And we talked about the different routes that those things can take through splanchnic nerves and things like that. Does this ring a bell at all? Okay, what was different about the route when it comes to going to the adrenal glands? Yeah, there really is no ganglion in that pathway. You have a preganglionic neuron that goes all the way to the target tissue, which is the adrenal gland or the adrenal medulla. But the cells that make up that adrenal medulla are not traditional endocrine cells. They, even though they don't have any axons, they are really just postganglionic neurons. So they're nervous tissue, really. Just in the medulla, not the cortex. The adrenal medulla is made up of cells that, because of their brownish color compared to the cortex, the medulla cells are called chromaffin cells. C-H-R-O-M-A-F-F-I-N. And these chromaffin cells are really just neurons, specialized neurons that don't look like typical neurons because they don't have an axon or an axon terminal, which is where neurotransmitters are normally released from. Instead, these are just round neurons that produce neurohormone, which, remember, is not a chemical distinction, it's just a functional distinction. They just release neurohormone from all sides of their round shape into the capillaries that are nearby in that adrenal medulla. So the blood picks up the neurohormone that the chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla produce. Okay? Anyone have any idea what those neurohormones are that are produced by the adrenal medulla? We talked about this in 201 as well. You should be able to give me at least one, the main one. Norepinephrine, right. And also some epinephrine. And also some dopamine. Although the dopamine is a very tiny amount compared to the norepinephrine and the epinephrine. Notice those three words, though. Epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine all end in I-N-E. They're examples of catecholamines. That we'll look at that word again later when we get to a different slide. But we talked about epinephrine and norepinephrine in 201, right? When we talked about that, when we talked about it in 201 mostly, we were talking about it in terms of it being a neurotransmitter, right? But remember, the word neurotransmitter is not a chemical distinguisher. It just tells you how that signal is being used. It's a neurotransmitter sometimes because it's released by neurons into just a synaptic cleft. Here, by the chromaffin cells, it's operating as a hormone. Same exact stuff chemically, but functionally it's being broadcast throughout the body now, so it's officially a hormone. Since those cells, though, are not traditional endocrine cells, but rather modified neurons, it's not just a hormone, it's specifically a neurohormone. All right? So what are these, the epinephrine and norepinephrine, these are hormones that are involved in what? What's the name of the response, the famous response that norepinephrine and epinephrine are involved in? Fight or flight response, yeah. These are hormones that act quickly in response to stress. Stress is including fear or pain, for instance. These things enter the bloodstream quickly and have an effect very quickly. There are slower responses to stress as well, but this is a quick response. By the way, what about the words, or just epinephrine for now? Epinephrine and norepinephrine, obviously, very chemically similar. But what does the word epinephrine mean? Why do we call it that? Right, epinephrine means really the same thing as adrenal. Nephros is a word that refers to the kidneys. The kidney, as we'll look at later, is broken into little individual functioning parts called nephrons. So epinephric is a word that really means on the kidney, just like adrenal means on the kidney. And this is why, as I talked about in 201, the same exact chemical goes by two different names in here versus Great Britain. Our word for the secretory product of the adrenal medulla is epinephrine. What's the British word? Adrenaline, from adrenal. Okay, so that's happening in the darker brown adrenal medulla, which is really nervous cells, like I said, postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system. The adrenal medulla, which is visible in cutaway here, is normally not visible because it's entirely surrounded by the adrenal cortex. And it's the adrenal cortex that we're looking at a close-up view of here in the right half of the image. So even though the cortex itself is one major layer of two, cortex and medulla, just the cortex by itself has a layered appearance. So there are three layers to the adrenal cortex, the ones shown here. Zona glomerulosa, zona fasciculata, zona reticularis is the order of those three zones working superficial to deep. And notice that by far, the thickest of the three is the zona fasciculata, which is the intermediate layer. Now, zona means zone. Glomerulosa is a word that means made of little balls. Glomer means little ball, or a gob. And you can see that little ball-like appearance. Looks like a bunch of little balls. Fasciculata, well, you should know what fascicle means, right, from 201. A fascicle is a column shape. So that's how things are arranged in the zona fasciculata. And what about reticularis? You should also know what that indicates. No? Well, yes, the ickle is little. What did I say? Reti means R-E-T-E? Because a reticle is really just a word that means a little reti. Reti is network. So reticular always refers to a kind of a net appearance because of branching. A highly branched or network-looking appearance, which is what you see here. Things are arranged in all directions. That's why they get that name. Now, these are not only histological distinctions, which you can clearly see upon dissection, but not surprisingly, these layers do at least slightly different things. In other words, they secrete their own products. But if we think about the whole thickness of the cortex, all three layers combined, the products that come out of the adrenal cortex are called what collectively? Well, let me tell you that chemically speaking, the hormones that the adrenal cortex produces are steroids. Not cortisols. Cortisol is the name for the liquid interior of a cell. Steroid ends in OID. And so the products of the adrenal cortex are called corticoids, meaning cortically produced steroids. Okay, corticoid is the most general word, but then you can get more specific from there. So there are three categories of corticoids. And the three categories are still not the names of individual chemicals. They're categories in their own right. But corticoids, as a general category, meaning anything produced by the adrenal cortex, are divided into mineralocorticoids, just the word mineral, O, corticoid, and those are produced by the superficial layer. The zona glomerulosa produces the mineralocorticoids. They are called that because the mineralocorticoids are signals that will adjust the level of minerals in the blood. And there are multiple mineralocorticoids, but the chief one is called aldosterone. Okay? A second category of corticoids are the glucocorticoids, which I mentioned that word last time. Glucocorticoids are so named because they're involved in homeostasis of glucose levels, or glycemia. And just like there are multiple mineralocorticoids, there are multiple glucocorticoids. The main one of those is cortisol. Did I just earlier say cortisol was the liquid interior of a cell? Sorry, I was thinking about cytosol. Cortisol is a hormone. It's a glucocorticoid. And this one also is a stress hormone, but with a slower action compared to epinephrine and norepinephrine released from the medulla. But the glucocorticoids, as a way of acting in response to stress, have a so-called glucose-sparing effect. Am I out of time again? Okay, so remind me to start with the glucose-sparing effect next time.